This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Howdy folks, a warm welcome from a dark Sweden. My name is Henrik and our website is RedIceCreations.com. All you regular listeners know that we invite many different guests on the program to discuss their ideas, theories, and opinions on a variety of different issues. We highlight research and material that hopefully will provide some new insight for you and help you to expand your perspective and hopefully learn some new aspects about the mysteries of this world. Today we're doing a round table discussion with Scott Onstott, Kevin McMahon, and Dan Tatman on numerology, geomancy, and geometry. Scott is behind the Secrets in Plain Sight films. Kevin has been doing videos on the International Peace Garden, the World Pentagram Ley Line Grids, and a 9/11 Great Circle. We also have Dan joining us in the first hour, who's been focused on the architecture and history of Bath in the UK, and how it relates to bigger issues from geomancy to Freemasonry. So, let's get started. All right, welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you all with us today for this round table on the commonalities and, of course, the differences between all of your individual work. It's going to be interesting diving into this. I haven't done a round table, I think, of with this many people on before, so it's going to be new for us here at Red Ice as well. But let's introduce you one at a time here so our audience can hear who's who and who they're going to hear here for the rest of the evening. So, Scott Onstott, you were with us last in June 2011. It's good to have you back. How have you been, Scott?
I've been fine. It's great to be with you again.
Definitely. Great job on the latest Secrets in Plain Sight, of course, Volume 2. I rewatched it today. I'm looking forward to highlighting some of the gems from your series here, Scott. So good work on that, first of all.
Thanks a lot.
And then we have Dan Tatman with us as well. You were with us in 2009, last time on the program. It's a while ago now, so it's good to have you back again. Thank you for coming on. What you've been up to, Dan?
Oh, I've been up to this and that, Henrik. Not a huge amount of focused research, but I've been carrying on my general research and studies, as you might call it, as I go. I've recently become a father. Well, I say recently.
Congratulations.
Yeah, my son's two now. So I've taken sort of an extended period of leave from any sort of focused work at all, just to focus on that.
Well, that's good. I think way too few people are doing that these days. They hand over the kids to the daycare or the school right away, huh? So we need some of that.
Yeah.
All right, really good. And then we have Kevin McMahon with us as well, new to the program. So why don't we just briefly talk a little bit about your interest in the work that you've been doing, Kevin. You've looked into the, among many other things, of course, but the International Peace Garden right there on the border between Canada and the States, and you've made larger connections to your videos to many other places as well. But tell us when you started making videos, Kevin.
Well, it all started early this year, 2012, back in February or so, after I saw actually Scott Onstott's first Secrets in Plain Sight video. It inspired me. He was using Google Earth to identify some different alignments on Earth that we'll probably get into, and I decided to go and check out some of his work and then started looking around myself. And synchronistically, things just started appearing, like connections between Washington and Egypt and the International Peace Garden, and then alignments with the geography of the Earth. So that's how that all unfolded.
Definitely. We'll get into some of that a little bit later as well. I guess, Scott, maybe we could begin a little bit with you, considering, again, your massive work that you've done on Secrets in Plain Sight, the video series, and where you think it might be appropriate, I guess, to begin a conversation like this when it comes to both numbers and symbols. But much of it is about ratios and relationship to other things in the world. And as you've gone into your series, one can begin to measure things, I guess, with the aid of time and gravity and distances. But where do you think that one should begin to look to kind of get a reference point? Some people say we should look for the stars or the planets or even our own Earth, again, going back to the very word geometry, of course, but where do you think it's appropriate to kind of begin as a reference point, as a starting point, Scott?
Well, there are many ways to look at the great mystery, and I like to start at the most fundamental, maybe, with number, because number is really at the root of everything, if you will. In the Quadrivium, they say that it's four subjects: number in itself, number in space, which is geometry, number in time, which is music or harmony, and number in space and time, which is astronomy. And so one way to look at this is to think of the individual qualities of the numbers 1 through 9, or the Ennead, if you will. If you compare 6 to 5, it's sort of a key that unlocks all this information. And in Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 1, I showed the Bent Pyramid in Egypt, which it has two different slope angles. And I had an animation in that video that shows how they unfold into a pentagon and a hexagon. And I was profiling the research of the people at world-mysteries.com. They showed how this unfolds. But basically, the Bent Pyramid is like a temple to this relationship between 6 and 5. And then I had that in the back of my mind, and I kept discovering more information about this ratio. You know, 6 over 5 is just the decimal 1.2, but it turns out that 6/5 times 5 squared is approximately equal to pi. And so this is like a harmonic that connects these two fundamental constants. And another thing I came across recently was the Earth's polar circumference. That is the circumference that goes through the North and the South Pole. It's equal to 6/5 times 33,333,333 meters. Hmm. And that's 99.98% accurate. And so that connects this 6/5 ratio with this string of threes. And so this single repetitive digit thing seems to be a key. And that comes up again and again in architecture and urban design and in these kind of interesting harmonies that we find. It's not just threes. It could be sixes or fives, like the Washington Monument is 555 feet or 6,660 inches high, approximately. And so also this comes into our personal lives with synchronicities that happen around times. I'll often look at the time and it'll be 11:11 or 1:11 or 3:33 or something like that, or 12:34. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4. And I know this happens to lots of people, but when it starts happening very frequently, I feel that I'm getting a message, sort of. It's like I'm on the right path to discover things. Pay attention to what's happening right now is what it's telling me.
Really interesting. And there's a lot of different systems as well. Maybe we can get into that later. But you've done a good job at examining these different types of, I guess, also master numbers. But we have 360 degrees, and then there's another update to that with the megalithic yard and the 366 degree system and everything else. And I guess that what we're all trying to find is a starting point, a reference point of kind of where to begin. And would you say, Scott, that a lot of this has to do with the, is it about Earth's relationship to maybe the sun and the moon, or is it the distances on the Earth itself between, let's say, man-made structures? Because I've always kind of wondered how the ancient people who came up with these systems and how they derived them and so forth, where they began, what they began looking at to kind of, you know, begin as a starting point.
Well, I think one great way to get into this is with the number 33. And so if you look at the distance between Stonehenge and the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, and you measure that in Google Earth, that turns out to be 33.33 degrees. And we don't normally measure point-to-point distances in degrees, But that is possible in Google Earth, and it compensates for the variable length of degrees according to the geoid or the exact shape of the Earth. And so one can look at this as just a coincidence, or it could be potentially something deeper than that. The dome of the rock itself is 33 miles from the sea.
Yeah.
And so we have all these 33s. And how did why did people use that number? Why is that important? Well, I have a whole string of connections here that I'll just read you some of them. Okay. It takes light 3.3 nanoseconds to travel 1 meter. The sun is 333,000 times more massive than the Earth. The volume of the sun is 33 orders of magnitude larger than a marble. And on the quantum scale, the shortest measurable length in the universe, called the Planck length, is 33 orders of magnitude smaller than a marble. So we're right in the middle in that gamut, if you will. Escape velocity, or the speed one must exceed to leave Earth, is 33 times the speed of sound, known as Mach 33. And incidentally, Mach 33 is 11.1 kilometers per second. So we have this connection to another string of repetitive single digits in the ones.
Interesting.
In my volume one, I talked about how middle C, which is sort of the midpoint of the range that we hear sound, is 33 harmonics above the Schumann resonance, which is the fundamental vibration of the Earth at 7.83 hertz. I can go on and on here. another one relating directly to us is the human spinal column has 33 bones, if you count the fused bones in the lower spine individually. So we have all of these amazing harmonics or correlations with this number, and such that you start wondering whether we're in a matrix or something where it's almost like an Easter egg. You know, are you familiar with the concept of Easter eggs in games?
Oh, sure, definitely.
Where, you're playing a level and you come across something and it opens up another level, or it's a secret sort of the programmers put in there for those people that just happen to find it. So I sort of feel like that. I'm coming across all of these coincidences and I'm wondering about the nature of reality. As a result,
I mean, that's what's so interesting about this too. As you pointed out there, Scott, that you can find it across the board in however you choose to measure something in distance, or I mean, it's 33 is there in feet, in miles, it's in kilometers per second, in miles per second, in just a number ratio or a measuring of 33, you know, x whatever. So it shows up in so many different measuring systems. So it's a it's a transcendental number almost. It supersedes the way we're measuring. And whatever system that we choose to use, it's almost like that we can find the 33 in it in one way or another. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and in my book, which is coming out on 11/11, I get into metrology and the way that we measure more. And I show that each one of the systems that are commonly used today it sort of has a sacred basis or this resonance with the larger system. And so, like a lot of people will dismiss the metric system. They'll think, well, maybe the imperial system is based on the Earth, but the metric system isn't. But it is, in fact. I just gave you that fact earlier about how 6/5 times 33,333,333 meters is the Earth's polar circumference. But also, the meter is related to time, and this is something Christopher Knight and Alan Butler showed in their book Before the Pyramids, when they talked about how the seconds pendulum is 1 meter in length. And, you know, with a pendulum, the length of it determines the period. And so it just so happens that a pendulum that is 1 meter long has a period of 2 seconds. 1 second in each direction. And so the meter is really fundamentally based on time and the Earth. And then if you look at the imperial system of measurement, John Michell and Robin Heath pointed out in their book, The Lost Science of Measuring the Earth, that the Earth's equatorial circumference is the number of days in the year, that's 365.242, times the number of degrees in a circle, that's 360, times 1,000 feet, and that's 99.99% accurate. So again, we have another indication that the English foot is based on time and the way that we measure a circle in a really elegant way.
Very interesting. Dan, we've talked about this many times in the past on past programs, as you've looked into, well, architecture, but also the notorious ties to Freemasonry, again, harking back to the degrees and everything else of it. What are some of the connections you can think about when it comes to your work on our architecture and building, Dan?
Sure. I guess to kind of take a step back from it, in a sense, I remember something that I've talked about with quite a few of my friends over the years, is to get a sort of deeper appreciation of number in a certain avenue of thought, at least. It's really interesting thought experiment to kind of put yourself back in a time back before numbers even had titles, you know. So if you're to put yourself back at a time where perhaps language isn't as sophisticated or complicated as it is, and we haven't assigned labels to everything yet, and yet the principle of there being three stones in front of somebody is still there, regardless of the language or the name, the title of the sequence number that it's within. And that really sort of hits home to me that number isn't this clinical mathematical thing, which we've kind of been entrained to think about a lot in a lot of avenues in society. It has this much deeper primordial principles which are going on within these sequences. I always find that a really fascinating and engaging thought to kind of go with. But also, kind of carrying on from that, if you still to stay in that avenue, a very early time, with time, say, before number in its orientation that we have. It's fascinating, obviously, Scott was talking about the base 9 and base 10 systems. And this obviously comes into it, is that it seems to have been formulated by pretty much every culture that we come into contact with. Yeah. They use the base 9 or 10. And this makes perfect sense because of the fingers, toes, the connection to the body. So a way of understanding these esoteric primal forces and principles which synchronize themselves in certain ways within reality, we've used the empirical system of our body to sequence that for relevance for us. That's one of the big things that I often come back to, because the world of number has become so complex as well. And in that way, it can kind of confuse you about what is originally at play, if you get my meaning.
Definitely. It's become very theoretical, and the fact is that the numbers is a representation of reality to a certain degree, to kind of be able to explain it in a simpler way, for example. Kevin, let's switch over a little bit to you here as we get you involved in the conversation here as well. Maybe you have some overall thoughts, obviously, on some of the things that are Dan and Scott has talked about already, but otherwise we could tie it back to some of the things that you found at the Peace Garden, and again, the relationships with other monuments and with other geometries using, well, what you've done is you've used basically the Peace Garden as your center focus and kind of built out from that, as far as I understand it.
Yeah. The Peace Garden pointed to two ridges in the Pacific Ocean that I was looking around one day, and I noticed that they formed a conspicuous angle to one another. And at first I thought it might be a hexagon, but when I went in Google Earth and started measuring it, it turns out that it's a giant pentagon. That this ties into what Scott was saying, because each of the sides of the pentagon, when it worked out with the geography, happened to be 3,333 kilometers per side. So if you can picture this with one point of the pentagon on the big island of Hawaii, and the other two sides are on these ridges, you can draw a pentagram within that, and that pentagram is lined up with the Great Pyramid of Giza. So you have it lined up with the Peace Garden and with the Great Pyramid of Giza. So now, as it turns out, there is suspected to be a star tetrahedron inside of the Earth. And if one point of that star tetrahedron, which sits inside of the sphere, would come out at 19.5 degrees north, which exactly corresponds to the Big Island of Hawaii. So you have this conspicuous volcano in the middle of the Pacific that is at one point of the star tetrahedron. Now, if you draw the other points of this star tetrahedron on the Earth, the point that happens to be in Africa on the opposite side, if you draw a line between the Big Island of Hawaii and this other star tetrahedron point in Africa, it also goes right through the Great Pyramid. And the reason I mention this is that a star tetrahedron, if you project it down onto two dimensions, forms a Star of David, which is inscribed in a hexagon and has six sides. So you have a pentagram grid appearing centered on the Big Island of Hawaii, as well as related to the star tetrahedron grid, which is centered on the Big Island of Hawaii and the Great Pyramid. So you have the six and the five, and the sides of the pentagon being 3,333 kilometers. So it, on some fundamental, the Earth is resonating with these numbers that Scott was initially talking about, is what I found. And that humans have marked this with monuments like the Great Pyramid and the International Peace Garden.
Right. This is like a, well, it's a play between the natural world, what's already there in the geography, and then what mankind has built on top of that. It seems to be kind of this play going on. And it's almost like some of the monuments have been to reinforce this natural geometry that already is there in a way, Kevin.
That's what it appears like. So furthermore, if each of the sides of that pentagon, if you extend them around the world so that each of them becomes a great circle, what ends up happening is you describe an icosidodecahedron, which is it's Archimedes' solid, if I'm pronouncing that right. And that particular solid has 12 pentagon faces on it and 20 triangle faces on it. So you end up with the triangles, with the 20 triangles, you can form 10 stars of David. And so again, you have the six and the five repeating in the icosidodecahedron. So that ties it into like a global scale. It's kind of like the Earth crystallized into this structure, and then monuments were placed at certain locations, possibly to influence the energetics of the structure.
Huh. Interesting. Scott, you've done a lot of work as well on looking at the pentagonal star, I guess, and examining the angles of that. And you've drawn out some pretty interesting information when it comes to how you can see different star formations, if we can call it that, with different arms going from five up to seven, up to placing, well, dividing the circle into both 24 and 36. But the fact is that all of these are to a certain degree based in the natural world, that these are patterns that somewhere along the line must have ignited mankind's creativity and sparked those ideas, and then we've kind of built on top of that. What would you say to that, Scott?
I think that you're exactly right there, and that maybe the ancient people were consciously aware of these things, and then somewhere along the line, the knowledge was forgotten, or perhaps preserved in secret societies. and now we're sort of recovering that information, or just noticing it again. And you mentioned the star, and what I noticed there is that the symmetry of the pentagon has outer and inner points every 36 degrees. And if you draw this out and mark every one of the degrees, and then keep going around the circle, so that you go past 360 degrees. You end up with all of these numbers, which end up being what John Michel called the canonical numbers. And they end up, you know, being the numbers that represent the sun, moon, and earth. And it also ties in with the precessional cycle. And amazingly, all of these numbers have the digital root of 9. And so what that means is that you take a number like 36, and you just add 3 plus 6, and that equals 9. So any number, no matter how many digits long, can ultimately be reduced to a single digit, and that's called its digital root. And if you look at the Fibonacci sequence, which is really a very elegant, beautiful, and simple concept, where it's a sequence of numbers that starts with 0, and then the next number is 1, and then the rule is that you just add the previous term you add the last two terms together to get the next term. So 0 plus 1 is 1, and then 1 plus 1 is 2. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. And the Fibonacci sequence, if you write it all out and then reduce it to the numbers to the digital roots, it turns out that the sequence repeats with a period of 24. So if you map all these numbers around a circle, so that you have 24 numbers going all the way around a circle, you'll find that all of the opposite numbers add to 9. So I think that's kind of amazing too. 9 being the highest numeral that we have. You know, in the decimal system, the next number we just revert back and we say it's 10. We use the concept of place to represent that. But 9 is really the highest quality. And this gets back to what Dan was saying about primordial principles of number. And so normally we think of number in terms of quantity, you know, how many widgets or how much money is that? But numbers in themselves have essential qualities, and there are only 9 of these. And so I think this relates to the Egyptian Ennead, you know, which is the 9 gods, and it relates back also to that that 9-sided figure I found in San Francisco in my Volume 1 film.
Well, remind people about that again, Scott. What was that?
Well, that was I was looking at the Transamerica Pyramid and all of the symbolism involved there, and I noticed that the street grid there has a 40-degree angle. There's this diagonal street called Columbus Avenue that cuts, it ends right at the Transamerica Pyramid. And it cuts through the grid of the city there at a 40-degree angle. And I just realized that there was potentially a 9-sided figure there. You know, because 9 times 40 is 360. And so I ended up drawing a 9-sided figure over the bay. And amazingly, one of the points is right there at the Transamerica Pyramid, and one of the edges goes right down Columbus Avenue. And then the next edge turns the corner so it lines up with the street grid. And incidentally, it's just one block away from Mason Street. And then it goes around, and then the top point points due north, and then over on another edge, it goes right along the edge of Treasure Island. So I knew I was onto something here, because it sort of indicates the orientation and length of that edge of Treasure Island and location. And so it seems like Treasure Island was deliberately placed in that location relative to all of the things I just mentioned.
Just to clarify, Scott, was that Oak Island?
Oak Island?
Is that the name of the island? Is it actually called Treasure Island? Okay.
Well, actually, the original island was called Yerba Buena Island. It's a natural island.
Fantastic,
and
yeah.
That's the island that the Bay Bridge goes through. But in the 30s, they built a man-made island there with landfill. And it's got seven sides, and it's called Treasure Island. And they made it for the World's Fair that was there. And, you know, yeah. There's so much more in that. Like, yeah. There's a pair of star-shaped barracks there, two asterisk-shaped barracks there. And I went there, and that's in this very important location because it's at the midpoint of this edge. And I went back there to see what was up with the barracks, because they're derelict, and they're going to build this 650-foot sun tower there. And I wanted to see if they had broken ground there on that. And I went there, and no, the barracks are still there, or they were in November 2011 when I went there. But right in front of them is this giant statue called Bliss Dance, this beautiful sculpture that used to be at Burning Man. And it's this incredible 40-foot-high goddess dancing there. And it sort of resonates with Isis.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah. Yep.
And so, you know, the Transamerica Pyramid right across the bay resonates with Osiris. You know, it's 864 mm-hmm. feet high if you count its 11-foot pyramidion, which is the solar number. The sun is 864,000 miles in diameter. And so we have this Egyptian thing, theme going on in the Ennead, which is, you know, the nine-sided figure. So it basically, in my research, it keeps pointing me back to ancient Egypt. And there's a great deal of wisdom there encoded in the Great Pyramid and in many of the structures there, of course. And it seems to be the focal point for a lot of the secret tradition.
Dan, you were thinking of Oak Island, the Templar treasure, right, that was buried buried there.
Precisely, yeah.
Why don't you, maybe you can just take us back a little bit to Bath and the research that you've done there, considering there is definitely a lot of nines in existence around Bath as well. Maybe you can just run through that a little bit for us.
Indeed, yeah. It's something which me and Scott have spoken about in the past is... one of the reasons I initially became interested in his work was the nine-pointed or nine-faceted figure, which he picked up on, because I'd also found the same thing in Bath. And this was to do with the complex, which is known as the Circus, which is, instead of it being an actual round building, it's an inverted circular complex. So where the building would usually be, there's a big vacant space in the center. So it's kind of like a donut, more than a spherical building. This complex has three entrances or exits that you can drive into with cars. And also, as we've talked about in the past, it's laden with over 526 emblems, alchemical emblems.
Yeah.
Above the first row of doors and windows on the complex. And at each level, there seemed to be kind of a layer cake effect of esoteric symbolism. And after sort of studying every level of this moving up, what I found was clearly with there being three entrances to this spherical complex, there was already implied a three in relationship with the circle. So, you know, to just look on this on Google Earth is what I used at first, just to put some lines and vertices on the complex from above. And so the first triangle is created for you by the exits or entryways into the complex. So that's a circle with a triangle perfectly in the center of it, which is one of the sort of definitive symbols that has been associated with alchemy throughout the ages. Apart from that, apart from the original inference of a triangle to be associated with the circular geometry. At the top layer, so above the third level, so the third row of windows up the building, just before the crown or the top of the building, there was another frieze of emblems. But this time, instead of them being a mixture of emblems from various forms of esotericism from Middle East, Middle Ages, Europe, and onwards, All you find in the frieze at the top is a collection of faces. After a closer inspection on this with various equipment and cameras, I had picked out that there were only three faces. There's either a small boy, a woman who's dressed in ceremonial garb, so she actually looks like Athena or Persephone, and then a gentleman who's dressed in the normal clothes of an industrious gentleman of the 1700s, 1800s, so he's wearing a cravat and a large collar. So you have three individuals. So they're all sequenced in a way so that you can't really make out any pattern. So I already thought that, hey, so there's three sides to the complexes, to the complex. There's three entrance or exit ways, and then there's three tutelary deities lining the top of it. So I thought that I should actually try and look deeper into this. So I used anupholite and various surveying equipment to actually chart the angles at which the faces were looking across the circle. And what I found was, it was mind-blowing, because there's been lots of books written on this complex and lots of tour guides that will take you around there every single day in Bath. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
Not one of them have ever talking about these faces in any of the books that I've read, and I think I've probably read all of them that there are. As I said, I was mind-blown by the fact that every small boy on this frieze at the top of the circle was looking across the circle to a woman, and every woman was looking back across the circle to a man, and every man was looking back at the original boy who was looking at the woman. So you had a sequence of triangles created, perfect equilateral triangles created by these three interlocking faces on the three different sides of the complex. Mind-blowing. And it also kind of gave the whole thing a much kind of deeper feel, because the frieze, which is on the lower edge of the complex, the alchemical frieze, just emblems and symbols, is almost indecipherable. It's such a long and complex sequence of symbols that if there was any original design, A, it's probably been lost, because a lot of the restoration which has been done by the stonemasons over the years meant that if a certain emblem had degraded, they wouldn't know what was originally there. So they just copied an emblem from the other side of the circle. So, as I say, part of it would be indecipherable because it has been changed, but it's also so complex that I was always kind of left thinking, I'll leave that to somebody else, because it was just too much of a thing to try and get at. But overall, what the complex as a whole was inferring was a connection to Djurkaeff. Well, at least Djurkaeff would have been connected to these ideas, the nine ways system. Nine archetypal paths. And this goes back through a long tradition into the Middle Ages, with kind of the birth of computers in their most primal sense, cipher wheels and code wheels. So there was a large connection between this enneagram or nonagram, which is created in these faces at the top of the complex, which showed that the architect who designed it went to, you know, extraordinary measures to get this correct.
Yeah.
But he didn't telegraph it in any way, so nobody knew. To me, it seemed very much that he was hinting that there was something to this nine-pointed figure in relation to code wheels, ciphers, and encoding of symbolism and geometry that people kind of previously weren't aware of within Western architecture. So that was initially why I was blown away by Scott finding almost the same thing, but in an inverted fashion.
Huh. Well, yeah, amazing. Tremendous amount of detail, obviously, that goes into that. And I want to ask you as well, Kevin, while we're on the subject of the Nine or the Ennead, if that's something that you've seen in some of your work on the Peace Garden, or some of the relationships to that.
If you start with the Earth and you impose, project the Earth down onto a 2D surface and then surround it with a nine-sided polygon, then if you draw enneagrams inside of that polygon, then those correspond to the center of it corresponds to the core of the Earth and to the boundary between the mantles. So there's this physical connection to the Earth. That's not my research, but it's just sort of a prelude.
Yeah.
What I found was that there's this resonance with the Earth and the physicality of it, and the Enneagram and the nine-sided polygon. What I found was that if you draw a line, a great circle around the Earth that goes between the International Peace Garden and the Peace Pyramid in Kazakhstan. So the Peace Pyramid in Kazakhstan it's a pyramid, obviously, and it's on a mall that's happens to be 4,444,444 yards from the Great Pyramid, which Scott Onstott discovered, and that led me on this down this rabbit hole. If you draw a line between these two places all the way around the world, the line, the continents are divided up along that line based on dividing the Earth's circumference by nine. If you divide the Earth's circumference by nine, it equals approximately or very close to 4,444 kilometers, is 1/9 of the Earth's circumference. So if you go around this line, it happens that it's 4,444 kilometers from the Peace Pyramid to the edge of the India continent. It's 4,444 kilometers along this line across Antarctica from one edge of the continent to the other. And it's 8,880 kilometers in between the International Peace Garden and the Peace Pyramid. So furthermore, you can go on with this. The line can end up being divided into two sections, one that is 4/9 and the other part that is 5/9. So there's this deep relationship that seems to be going on between these monuments and the actual structure of the Earth somehow.
Fascinating. Now, I wanted to go back, Scott, to one thing you mentioned before as well about the number of the sun, 864, and also I know that there was a 24 in there somewhere. I'm going back to the measurement of time and how we break things down and the fact that we can have, well, these days anyway, 24 frames per second in the how we capture a movie or the film, you know, from a film camera. And you had this really interesting stuff in there. I want to ask you a little bit more about that, about the measurement, the millimeter, the square millimeter, you know, surface basically on a film from a film camera that captures the sunlight onto it. And the fact that this actually has a relationship to the geometry, to the measurement of the sun itself. That's pretty incredible. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the 35 millimeter film format is actually, if I remember right, it's 24 by 36 millimeters for the area of it. And that ends up being 864 square millimeters. And so this seems to be the most appropriate size to capture the light of the sun. There's this resonance there. Also, a 24-hour period is 86,400 seconds. And so this ties in with the size of the sun, if you will, because it uses this same number canon, 864. See, it doesn't really matter the number of zeros that you have, because zeros indicate scale in the decimal system. And this gets in deeper to how the decimal system itself seems to resonate with the architecture of the universe. And this is, I can talk about that a bit, if you like.
Sure, why not? I wanted to, I guess as well, but you know, I wanted to ask Dan a little bit more about some of the things that you wanted to discuss or tie into, if there's something else you wanted to comment on here. But I also wanted to give you a little opportunity, Dan, to talk about some of the, I guess, some of the work that you've done, and it doesn't maybe directly relate to this, although on a subtle level it might do. But I want to give you some time for that as well, Dan. So please go ahead if you wanted to do that.
Yeah, sure. Well, as I said before, I've been doing this and that, which has entailed I've been helping other people to build their houses. So straw bale, cob houses, a few other different types of construction, and going and visiting communities and places that have actually tried to get things off the ground with not just one or two houses, but, you know, up to 30, 40 houses. The people all trying to build low emission buildings, which also have an awareness of geomantic principles. So one group that I spent some time was with Lammas in Pembrokeshire in South Wales, which is particularly fascinating because they're on the slope of the Priscilly Mountains, which is where the stones for Stonehenge came from. So, the majority of the stone and outcropping which they were using for foundations and block stones there was the same as Stonehenge. So that was pretty good. I'd say it's actually the most practical, applicable part of geomancy, in a sense, is creating communities and homes and places to live. So I kind of disagree with you there, but it's vaguely connected in that it's actually the real work itself, and the rest of it is kind of the planning and orientation of that said work. But I know what you're saying. I'm not not having a go. So there's lots of these groups happening, and obviously a lot of people who are coming through the alternative scene are quite individualistic the way that they do things. So I'm not encouraging people particularly to go out and start communities, because it can be real hard work getting something off the ground and to work with a few different people who've got different ideas about it. But I've just been trying to look into what is successful, what you can do, and taking into that whole construction process, you know, an attempt at a deeper sort of appreciation of geomancy along with construction. That's where a lot more of my focus has been, because also I want to get to the level when I do build my own, that it can be something really incredible that I could perhaps use as a showcase to get on mainstream TV or something. Who knows? You know, it's nice to try a few things out, you know. So that's kind of what I've been doing and slowly chipping away on. That's all about what I needed to say about that. I guess we could throw up a few links to some of these places and projects which are being associated with, and people can go and be inspired by that.
Maybe you can just briefly tell us about, well, let's say someone doesn't really know about the geomancy aspect to this, or the level of how it connects. Maybe you can just talk about that a little bit.
For me, kind of more of my impetus, obviously, as I mentioned Stonehenge before, the constructors of Stonehenge went to, you know, huge amount of difficulty to get the stones which they used to the site. So this was obviously of primal importance to them. And you do see that through the majority of all ancient architecture. They're very fastidious with the types of stone and mineral outcrops which they're using and building upon. So it just means, you know, taking into account when you're building, the materials that you're building with. There's no kind of massive scientific manual on what buildings to or not to build with. There are some from sort of mainstream architectural things. There's breathability of materials, things which will hold or release moisture. But there isn't any real book to read on geomancy. I'd say that...
Sure.
Geomancy and applied to construction. There are books around, but nothing's definitive. You know, it's still a work in progress. I do think that, you know, using as little amount of chemically created products, as much live products and materials and resources that you can use, and locally sourced materials as well, not just on a, it costs less to take the, you know, to transport resources around, but also in the way that harmonizing with your environment helps on a dietary level and lots of other levels as well. So it seems like that's a big part of it, to kind of be living on and off the land that you're actually building on, rather than relying on lots of different geographical locations for resources and energy.
Indeed. It goes to a deeper level of basically using, as you said, the right materials to build your living space and everything else, and having it to become alive, because if it is again something with the energies of the movement through the earth with everything, I could just imagine if you place a non-conductive kind of a dead material on top of that, you're not going to maybe enhance that experience significantly. But if you use the right materials, maybe it is something that, you know, you'd both see benefits from, but also you would actually, you know, feel much better in the environment that you're, you know, spending most of your time in.
Absolutely. And I think probably over the next 50 years, we're going to see some more data and information coming out on this. Obviously, things like lead in paint and asbestos being used in building materials is kind of seen as a no-no now. And I think that that will kind of step into some other building materials and other processes that we do without thinking at the moment. I think that it will slowly change just as our level of information on the properties of these things improves, you know.
Indeed. While we're, you know, we're visiting England here for a little bit, then talking about some of the things here, I wanted to go back to that, Scott, and kind of tie in. I mean, you've looked at Stonehenge, and again, you've looked at the work of Knight and Butler, for instance, of the megalithic yard and a lot of other concepts from there. But there seems to be a really strong relationship between England and some of the more ancient sites around the world, connecting with Giza, with Baalbek, and there's a number of interesting connections here. Why is this, do you think? Why do we have the ancient world and then England so prominent in all of this? What do you think, Scott?
Well, that's a great mystery, and I think it relates to why we see most of the crop circles happening in southern England. You know, it's like the ear is on the body, where it's all the acupuncture points are right there in the ear. Maybe southern England is like the earth's ear, in a way, where it connects with everything else in some subtle way. And incidentally, I wanted to tell you, Dan, I have a practical suggestion for the community project that you're working on, and that is if you build garden beds that are 5 by 12 feet exactly, then sure, they will have an area of 8,640 square inches, which would resonate with the sun. And so this might be a way that you can, you know, harmonize the size of a garden bed with the larger cosmic picture.
Yeah, it's a great idea. These are the sort of things that I'm very much interested in. When you get to really actually putting it into practice, there's so many variables depending on the slope of the land, the orientation of the land, and perhaps trees around it and things like that, that sometimes some of your neat geometric work that you plan out on doing doesn't actually work out quite like that. But you're absolutely right. We have to be putting thought into ideas like this in order to, well, not have to, but I think it would be a good idea at this point in order to be as efficient as we can with our resources, you know.
Exactly. And there's this difference between the geometric world of ideas, where everything can be precisely measured, yeah, and the real world, where things are always off. There's always a gap there. It's sort of like the Pythagorean comma in music, where we have always a gap between the cycle of 12 fifths and 7 octaves. It's almost perfect, but it's about 1% off.
Yeah.
And so I find that the real world is always, there's always this gap there, and yeah, at least that's how I think of it when I look at all of these facts I present, and it says 99.98% accurate.
Yeah.
It's never going to be exact, because we live in a world of material reality where you can't have phi as the length. It has to be some more discrete distance, you know, a whole number of inches, for example.
Yeah, and I mean, an example of that would be the human body. Even when you reach your adult height, your height still does fluctuate, can go up and down. Your weight, the measurements of your body. So it's a great example, because everything that is dynamically connected to life or is alive is dynamic in all of its measurements. So,
and it's
that's kind of the beauty of it.
Also, the human body is based on the pentagram, obviously, right? I mean, you have a head, two arms, two legs, that's 5. Each of your hands is 5. Each of your feet is 5. And even your face is an inverted pentagram if you take a look and connect your eyes and your ears and everything. But, and so there's 5 relationships in the body. But none of them are exact, right?
No.
But it's just expressions.
Oh, they are in their own
deeper
way,
There's this deeper architecture, but coming through the imperfection of manifestation, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Scott, do you wanted to add on to that something?
Oh no, I was just commenting on how Jan was saying the body is it's never sort of perfect. It's fluctuating. Even in your life, you get a little bit taller or a little bit shorter. It's sort of like breathing. It's alive. And so there's always this dynamism there. And we just need to be sensitive enough to tune into that, to take it seriously when we see these correlations, and to just make a mental note of them. Because if we're stuck on only accepting things that are absolutely exact, we miss a great deal of phenomena. You know, we don't perceive so much. So I think by opening your mind to these things and becoming more sensitive, there's a whole world out there to discover. It's like there's a whole subtle science that could be recovered.
Well, Scott, I mean, speaking about movements, I mean, I think that's an excellent point you bring up, that the whole system is in motion, constant flux, from the largest part to the smallest. We have movements of the atom, but then, as you pointed out in your Secret in Plain Sight, the Volume 2, that it's also potential even that our entire solar system is actually moving in a binary relationship with the Sirius system, and also therefore our measurements of, let's say, the precessional cycle is something that is constantly fluxing and changing.
That's right. That's Walter Cruttenden's research at the Binary Research Institute, and he talks about how the scientific data really fits this pattern, where because Sirius does not precess, all the other stars do. And so it reveals that we're actually in a binary system with the Sirius system. And the overwhelming majority of stars are binaries, so why not ours? And our precessional rate per year changes as we move through our elliptical orbit that we have relative to the Sirius system. And in the past, the precessional rate per year was closer to 72 years. That was like the maximum amount of time it would take to precess 1 degree. And now, as we're moving closer to the center of mass that we have with Sirius, the rate of precession is decreasing. So, or rather, the rate is increasing, and the rate the number of years per degree is decreasing. So now we're closer to 66 years per degree. Or rather, that's the average, is 66.66 years per degree. And apparently the other limit would be 60 years. 60 years per degree of precession would be the minimum number.
Wow.
So it varies, and that sort of works with it allows us to understand the 25,920 year great year, which is what is the traditional value. That's based on a 72 year per degree rate. But if we look at Sri Yukteswar, who was a Indian sage, and he claims that the precessional rate was exactly 24,000 years.
Nice.
And that's exactly what Walter Cruttenden is saying now. That's the number that best fits the scientific data. So here we have a person who found that out through science in the exterior world, and then we have Sri Yukteswar, who is guru of Yogananda, and he plumbed the interior world within and was able to come up with that same value.
And also he came from a lineage, I guess. You know, this is part of the imparting of the knowledge through, you know, the preeminence of Priyukteswar was probably through some sort of lineage, as well as, you know, I just wanted to add that. You know.
That's right. So it connects with the ancestors, and it connects directly to the information within.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's as above, so below, again, where we have the, in some way, the exterior world is mirroring our interior worlds.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a bit of a stretch then, Scott, but what do you think that that says about, let's say, time prophecies, things that are related to numbers in that way, you know, 2012 and all that, right? But, you know, when it comes to exact time measurements and that this is what it is, if this is in constant flux, there's maybe not much certainty in those things that we set up, including calendar systems that needs to be updated, perhaps. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I certainly would love to revisit our calendar because it's so confusing and wrong. I mean, look at how September, October, November, December all mean 7, 8, 9, 10, and they're out of sync because, you know, their months are the wrong number. And in my book, Taking Measure, I profile a lot of different calendar systems and show how there's a more ancient system that makes a lot more sense. It's based on 13 months of 28 days each. So each month has 4 weeks of 7 days each, and that adds up to 364 days. And so at the end of the year, you can have a 1 or 2 days out of time as a holiday. And this makes it's much more of an elegant system, I think, compared to our current calendar.
Was that the Dream Spell calendar?
That's the I think it's called the International Calendar. Let me look it up. International. If I'm just blanking on the name right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sure. No worries. I think I only reason I recall is because I think I heard the same division, if you will, of the year from the Dream Spell calendar, which was it Argulis or something that came up with that?
Yeah, it was Argulis. Right. Yeah, it's close to that if it's not that itself. Yeah.
All right, very interesting. This is going very quick here, but I think we should maybe get in a few more things here before we take a break. Again, I wanted to, talk a little bit about some of the numbers and why they are associated with, have become to, you know, be associated with evil things. You did a good, again, Scott, a good breakdown of 666 in the video, and that so many things relate to this. And again, I guess it goes back to the magic square of the sun. Why do you think, Scott, that 666 has been so heavily demonized when it simply explains so many things in the natural world, and it seems to point more to, I think, the sun than anything else?
That's right. Well, the magic square of the sun, which was published by, I think it was Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa, and he has that magic square published, I think it was in the 16th century, and it relates the the sum of each row or column is 111, and then of course if you add up all the rows or columns you get 666. And I think it's more of a recent phenomenon where people demonize 666 and call it the number of the beast. In the Bible it says it's the number of a man.
Yeah, precisely.
And so I think really you have to look at that and break through the kind of fear around the number 666. And I find the sort of interest in all the numbers that have a single repetitive digit, like 555, 666, 111, they all have something to teach us.
Indeed. Maybe we can return a little bit more to Kevin here. We're going to take a short break in a little bit. It's going very quick, the time here, but it's all right. What have you found a little bit in your work, Kevin, in terms of, well, maybe some of the numbers here as well, or again, back to the relationship to some of the other things that we've talked about, Kevin?
Well, first off, it's interesting how 666 is being demonized, but also the pentagram is being demonized, as being satanic, the inverted pentagram. So taking these sacred symbols and because, you put a pentagram on something and that immediately evokes a response in people, like draw a pentagram on the earth, for example, and see what people might say about it, right? It's kind of the work of the devil and things. I haven't, there's an interesting relationship to Phi and 666 that I don't, it's a little abstract here, but Phi, the golden ratio, is equal to the negative sign of 666, minus the cosine of 6 times 6 times 6. Just another tidbit to throw into the conversation. But I've been finding that the repeating numbers have a huge influence in the work that I'm doing. And for example, there's a pentagram in the Pacific that I talked about earlier, and there's also one centered on the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. And the centers of those two pentagrams are 6,666 kilometers apart, and which happens to be 1/6 of the Earth's circumference, more or less. Mm. Like Scott says, to 99% accuracy or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's also, I've been looking at how the highest peaks on the Earth and the deepest lakes on the Earth seem to be related to one another. And for example, if you take the Mount McKinley in North America and line it up with Machu Picchu, so Mount McKinley or Denali is the tallest mountain in North America, and you line it up with Machu Picchu and it goes over top of the continental divide of North America, and it goes over the highest point in the Rockies and right down the border of Alberta and British Columbia. So there's this natural resonance. Now, if you take that line and extend it, it can be 444,444,444 inches. And at that point, it intersects the pentagram grid, that one of the great circles of the grid that I drew that's centered on the axis of the Great Pyramid. Now, if you take another line and draw it through Mount Everest, the tallest point on Earth, and Lake Baikal, which is the deepest point, the deepest lake on Earth, that line also goes directly to that same point on the 444,444,000 point. And it also extends from the farthest you can go across Asia. So from the very northwest part to the very southern part of India.
Hmm.
Now, if you extend this line to 444,444,444 inches, it hits the pentagram grid at the point in Alaska and also at the southern point of India. So there's this larger relationship going on. Incidentally, 444,444,444 inches just so happens to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9 yards. Hmm. There's this coincidence. So
just a coincidence. Nothing to worry about. That's right. well, gentlemen, why don't we, before we take a little break here, I want to give out sources, of course. I've said this before now, that time is moving really quick, but we're obviously just scraping the surface here and getting into it. But before we take a break, where can people go to find out more? Kevin, let's begin with you, and where people can see your video series, and you're continuing to upload new material all the time, basically. So tell us about that.
I have a website, peacegardensecrets.com, and I also have a YouTube channel, Peace Garden Secrets, on YouTube. So you can go to either of those and check it out.
All right, very good. Scott, give out your details as well. And again, I want to help you plug there the Volume 2 of Secrets in Plain Sight. I rewatched it today and saw it a couple of weeks ago now, and it's really interesting. You've done a great job at it and dug out a lot of interesting information and driving this from a lot of work of other people. And it's very good made, and people can, of course, see the first Volume 1 on your website as well. So tell us where we can go to find out more, Scott.
Yeah, you can go to secretsinplainsight.com and find out everything that I'm working on. And I have Volume 2 available now. You can buy Volume 1 and 2 on DVD, or you can download them. And I also will be coming out with a book called Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness, that's coming out on 11/11.
All right, very good. We're going to have these links up. Dan, how about you? Do you have your website still going?
I do, yeah. I very occasionally go over and put a little post up there for people who do follow it. So that's still thebathmysteries.blogspot.com. And I've also done a lot of shows with you, Henrik.
That's right.
For anybody who wanted to really get the skinny on a lot of my ideas, then go back into the archives, go back to and listen to some of the shows that we did together. And if you're not a subscriber, then you probably should be, because it's the best program on the planet for this sort of information.
So well, there you go. That's a nice plug. Thank you for that, Dan. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much here for the first hour. And you'll be leaving us here for this time, Dan, anyway. But we hope we can have you back soon and, of course, continue all of this. But it's been good having you with us. So thank you for your time and thank you for your input, although it went very fast this hour here. But we appreciate it nonetheless.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks a lot, mate.
All right, and guys, Scott and Kevin, stay with us here. We're going to take a short break then, and we'll return with more in a little bit. We'll be right back.
I left alone. My mind was blank. I needed time to think, to get the memories from my mind. What did I see? Could I believe that what I saw that night was real and not just fantasy? Just what I saw in my old dreams, were the reflections of my woman staring back at me? Cause in my dreams, it's always there, the evil face that twists my mind and brings me to despair. Oh,
second hour is coming up. We are going to continue with Scott and Kevin to discuss everything from 9/11 and the World Trade Center site to cosmic harmonies. Scott shares his insight into what he calls the four encoders, basically those responsible for the patterns and the synchronicities. We go from the 6-5 ratio to Sion and 33. We also discuss time, calendars, ancient and modern measurements. Hope you stay with us for more as we continue the conversation and discuss these big concepts and ideas from the mysterious superconscious mind of the cosmos. Go to redicemembers.com and have a look at our subscription options when you want to hear more. We have some great programs coming up as well. Let me read you some of our guests. Richard Cassaro on Secrets Written in Stone. And we have John Lash, Richard Allen Miller, Gerald Salente. And further ahead, we have Johan Oldenkamp, Eric Karlström, G. Edward Griffin, David Talbot, John Major Jenkins. And then we have another roundtable, this time actually on 2012, one of the final ones on that subject. This is with Jay Widener, Barbara Henklow, and Lawrence Joseph. And also further ahead, we have Dean Clifford, Patrick Flanagan, and Rupert Sheldrake will be joining us as well. You're welcome to tune in again when we're back with more. This is Radio On Demand, so you can tune in when it pleases you, and we spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking banners. You can stream or download. Use our mobile apps for Android or iPhone and iPad. Check out our RSS feeds if you haven't already. But right now, we're going to move ahead with Hour 2 coming up. Thank you for listening and for staying with us. RedIceMembers.com is the website.